In the second part of my talk, I'll be discussing how dark matter particles interact with neutron stars. As I'll be telling you, the interaction is not that as dramatic as this picture, but there is something related to this phenomenon. So the outline of my presentation will be first starting with a very brief introduction on the problem and the dark matter puzzle. And then I'll divide the presentation in two parts. The first one is very similar to what I presented last year here, so I'll be very brief, and it's about black holes as dark matter particles for light bosons. Mostly I'll be discussing superoriented instabilities, which are the key ingredient for this, essentially for having interest in phenomenology for this part, for these systems. And in the second part will be a different topic. I'll be discussing neutron stars as dark matter probe, specifically in the context of putting constraint on the dark matter fraction in primordial black holes. So I don't think that I need to justify very much the motivation with this audience. Let me just tell you that the dark matter problem is essentially a missing matter problem. There are many different evidences that point to the fact that there is much more matter than essentially there is much more matter in the gravitational sector than what we see in the electromagnetic channels. The probably the most famous result is the rotational curves of galaxy, which instead of decaying as the Kepler law should predict, they are more or less flat at large distances. And this can be explained by the fact that the dark matter halo contains a lot of matter that we don't see in the electromagnetic channel. People have tried to modify gravity to understand, essentially to modify gravity at galactic scales to reconcile these results, but it's very difficult to reconcile this picture, these results here, the fact that we see strong gravitational lensing at galactic scales, that we see confined hot gas in galaxy clusters. So there are many different observations that all point out to the fact that dark matter is a huge component of the universe, essentially. And the same was actually recently confirmed by the Planck mission. So in this is essentially in this scenario, people have started building the dark matter candidates, and there are actually many of them. Probably the most famous one is the so-called weakly interacting massive particles that are very common in supersymmetric extension of general relativity, so-called WIMPs. These are particles with mass, say, above 100 GeV or more. And on the other end, we also have very light particles, like axions, that were first proposed to solve the strong CP problem in QCD. And they are very light, so the mass is below, say, 1 eV. So they are very different from each other, and they have different phenomenology. Similar to axion, we have also other kind of light bosons, so like vector fields with very small masses, and other objects which are very different, for example, massive astrophysical compact halo objects, so-called machos, which are essentially dark matter in the sense that they don't emit because of high redshift, but they are, say, composite objects. Yet different are primordial black holes that I will discuss in the second part of my talk. So the main point is that we would expect a lot of different phenomenology depending on the kind of dark matter that populates the universe. And in this scenario, black holes and neutron stars especially, and other compact objects, would be interesting because of various effects. The first one for black holes is that they are extremely simple. So they are just described by the mass and the spin, essentially. And the Noether theorem guarantees that any sort of black hole in a stationary configuration in the universe is described by the Kerr metric. So essentially, we can use this as a background to study the interaction of any kind of dark matter. And the other important point is the equivalence principle of general relativity, because any kind of dark matter gravitates the same way. So we know very well, and it's in a very simple fashion, how dark matter couples with vacuum solution like black holes or compact solution like neutron stars. Neutron stars, on the other hand, have another important property. They are, of course, not as simple as black holes, but in this context, they are important because they are so dense that essentially they enhance the interaction cross-section between dark matter and, say, nucleons even though the cross-section itself is very small, the probability of our interaction is inside this ultra-dense region is very high. So now let me go to the first part of my talk. So black holes as probes for light bosons. In this picture here, I'm trying to essentially represent a spinning black hole, because what I'm going to say is mostly about spinning black holes. And the reason is this process here called superradiance, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. Let me just tell you very briefly that superradiance has a very interesting history. In the context of black holes, probably started, can trace back to the work of Zeldovich in the 70s. And this is actually Zeldovich's original paper, 1971. It was studying the scattering of a wave of a rotating cylinder with some absorbing surface. And he found that the reflected wave was amplified if the frequency was small enough. And in the original paper, he recognized two quite impressive things. Well, the first is that if you replace the cylinder by a black hole, the role of the absorbing surface is played by the event horizon. And so essentially, he predicted that the same effect should actually occur in the Kerr case. And the second one is even more amazing, because he understood that when you take quantum effects into account, you should have spontaneous emission of radiation. And this was a couple of years before Hawking's discovery of the black hole evaporation. And actually, Hawking acknowledged that this, the work of Zeldovich and Starobinsky inspired his work. Exactly. So this is the main difference. So they were only actually in the Hawking's book, Brief History of Time, he really says that he was essentially uneasy with the fact that it was only for the rotating case. While he started doing the computation, he saw that also in the static case you can get emission.
Sorry, you mean the Hawking radiation was inspired by this?
Right. Okay. It was just a couple of years after. So more precisely, in the black hole case, the process is the following. You throw a wave of a rotating black hole, and when the frequency of the wave is smaller than this number here, omega h is the angular velocity at the event horizon, the reflected wave is amplified. There are many ways to understand this picture. You may think that around a Kerr black hole there is an ergo region in which negative energy states can exist, essentially. But I think that the key ingredient is dissipation. So the fact that you have an event horizon that acts as an absorbing surface, actually a perfect absorbing surface. And indeed, this process is very similar to tidal heating at the event horizon. For what I'm going to say next, the important thing to remember is that this amplification depends not only on the spin of the black hole. Of course, if the black hole spins fast, superradiance is larger, but also on the spin of the field. So scalar fields are amplified less than electromagnetic waves. Electromagnetic waves are amplified less than gravitational waves. And the important point for dark matter searches is that if you find a way to confine this superradiant energy, like in this picture here, so suppose you put the black hole inside a cavity, what you get is a sort of laser. So you start growing modes close to the black hole. They cannot escape because they are inside this cavity, and they create this sort of cascade, in another sense than what we heard before. And, well, you create what President Tukowski in the 70s called black hole bomb. So it's an instability at a linear level you see as an exponentially growing mode. So there are many different confinement mechanisms to essentially trigger this instability. Some important ones are if the black hole is inside, say, an ADA space-time, because the ADA boundaries play the same role as a cavity. But what I'm going to focus today are bosonic fields, so essentially. Because a mass term can confine low-frequency waves the same way that a mirror does for any kind of frequency, and this triggers an instability too. There are also other kind of confining mechanism, one that we are very recently studying in Lisbon, are the role of magnetic fields that are actually quite common close to massive black holes in the universe, and they also can confine radiation. There is a very simple way to understand the instability timescale for this process. Suppose that you have a small black hole inside this cavity. The cavity is put at a distance R naught. Well, then the black hole, essentially, you think about the radiation being reflected n times at the cavity boundaries and either absorbed or amplified at the horizon, depending on the superion condition. You can compute a cross section for each encounter, essentially, and then you can also compute how the amplitude is amplified or absorbed, essentially. And then this gives you, very simply, combining these two equations, gives you the instability time scale, which is just 1 over the imaginary part of the mode, and gives you this scaling, which we also will observe in any kind of numerical computation that we do when you have perfect confinement.
But what is L?
N is the number of times that the wave
L,
is.
L
is the harmonic number, so you decompose the perturbation in harmonic indexes. This is the harmonic angle of the spherical harmonics. Sorry, what did you say?
I mean, all L's exist in nature, so I mean.
All right. So, yeah. Well, it happens that the high L is highly suppressed.
Okay.
So the.
You should just pick the lowest L.
Right. Yeah. The lowest L that gives you an interesting result. Since this. How is that? Yeah. Since you have this condition here, the lowest is L equal 1, at least for scalar waves, because then you want M to be different than 0. Given essentially this quantitative idea, it's very simple now to understand why a massive scalar field is unstable around a Kerr black hole, and this was the reason why all this essentially work started. Because, even at linearized level, if you take the massive Klein-Gordon equation and you try to solve it on a fixed background, on a Kerr background, what you find are unstable modes, whose time scale in the most favorable condition is 10 to 6 times the mass of the black hole. And this gives you tells you two things. So one is that it's very difficult to do numerical simulations because you have to evolve your system for 10 to 6 times your unit, essentially. And the other one is that if you put here the mass of of a massive black hole, like a solar mass black hole, this instability time scale becomes of the order of the seconds. So it's much shorter than any kind of dynamical scale for astrophysical objects. Interestingly, so for a given mass of the black hole here, this was actually recognized by Arvanitaki and collaborators a couple of years ago. So for a given mass of the black hole, only a window in the scalar field masses is actually gives you interesting instability. And the reason being that if the mass is too small, the instability time scale is huge, much longer than the age of the universe even. And if the mass is too big, actually it's exponentially suppressed. This was shown by Early and Zorus back in the 80s. And so essentially only a window in the mass of these scalar fields are important phenomenologically. The important point is that since we do observe black holes with very different masses, ranging from solar mass to supermassive black holes, essentially, and in principle we will be able also to observe intermediate mass black holes, well, we can essentially span all this region in the parameter space and essentially probe phenomenologically a region that goes between 10 to minus 10 electron volt and 10 to minus 20 electron volt. So the mass of this field is really, really tiny. But there is interesting motivation to consider this field. You may ask, what happened to this instability? Is really like a bomb or is something less dramatic? For black holes, is surely something less dramatic, and we can actually do educated guess even without computing, say, the full nonlinear problem. And the reason is that sometimes, as shown in this picture, you may actually guess what is the end state of the instability. Like in this picture here, you may understand that something very, very wrong may actually happen. For a black hole, actually, is not as bad, because we can compute the fluxes at the horizon, and what we observe is that the energy and the angular momentum are extracted from the event horizon because of superradiance. So the picture is that because of this instability, the field grows close to the horizon. The horizon spins, the black hole spins down, loses energy and angular momentum, and essentially there is this energy transfer from the black hole to the scalar cloud around the black hole. And so there is a clear prediction for this scenario. which is the following. If this sort of light bosons or light, say, axions exist in nature, we should not observe highly spinning black holes. And the reason is that if you plot what is called Regge plane in the angular momentum and versus mass plane of the black hole, what you find are threshold lines here above which any black hole should be unstable with an instability timescale shorter than, say, accretion timescale. Because, of course, accretion tends to spin the black hole up, while superradiance tends to spin the black hole down. And so, essentially, you should not observe any black hole in this region here, for example, if there exists a field with 10 to minus 18 electron volt. But since we do observe black holes there, we can reverse the argument and rule out interesting region of the mass parameter space of this solution. And something that I want to stress is that this is something that can be already done and in the future can be done only better because, well, essentially because these error bars here will become smaller. Yes, please.
What is the definition of those lines?
So this line here is the region where the instability time scale due to superradiance equals the atypical accretion time scale. So it means that above this line here, the time scale for instability is shorter than the accretion time scale.
What is the typical accretion time scale?
It's 10 to 7 years. In this case, take the Salpeter time. So what will happen is that if a black hole is there in an order of time, like seconds, it will go down losing angular momentum and mass. So yeah, the prediction actually is that this Regge plane should be populated with some gaps. So it should populate in this way here, below each of these lines, depending on the mass.
These observations, does that mean that like we could find black holes, like rule out higher masses? Sorry, lower masses?
Right, that doesn't.
Going to be black, like, should we expect to find things in the rest of that plate?
That is a possibility. For example, we do already have observation in this region here for the mass, which is much simpler to compute. We don't have still already yet, actually. Observational measurements of the spin. So in principle, we can populate this region here. Of course, there are no probably black holes with larger mass, but yeah.
Are you concerned about strong selection effects in the observations? I mean, a lot of these angular momentum measurements, I'm guessing, come from iron line measurements.
Oh, yeah.
The iron line measurements won't see slowly spinning black holes.
Right.
So maybe they're just looking at the handful that happen to have just been spun up.
It is true, this is actually related to what I'm going to say next. So there are actually some debates that these numbers here could be smaller, somewhere around here, depending on a lot of effects. And well, it's something that people have to take into account and also is related to the fact that in the future we could do just better because with different observation and different kind of measurements, we can improve this number.
I thought this was a saltpeter time is what's giving the giving one of the sides of this turn up, right? And so if it just spun up in the last million years, then that would shift where those turn ups were. Or you're right. It's a 1 second growth time.
Basically, should see none.
You should see none in that case. Right. But it might shrink the limits here.
Is that right?
But this limit is 10 to 7 years, not 1 second. So that's.
Yeah.
I mean, if you make it 1 second, I'm guessing it's going to push
it. Yeah,
it
goes up, yeah.
So if we were to change the time scale by an order of magnitude, say it was 1 million instead of 50 million.
Yeah. So I can show you, not in this bit, let me show you a different one. So here, I'm showing this blue line here is the, actually this dotted line here is for the Salpeter time and the blue one is for the Hubble time. So there are more than three orders of magnitude difference. So this is the kind of difference that you get when you change the time scale. Right. Okay, so this was for scalar field and was done mostly by my Italian collaborators a couple of years ago. So what we did last year was to extend this program to vector fields for two reasons. One is that because vector fields are also interesting dark matter candidates when they are light. And the other reason is that, well, actually there are three reasons. The other reason is that The action for vector fields is very complicated. There is mixing between these particles and the standard model fields. But when it comes to black hole physics, the beauty is that if you are just interested in understanding the dynamics of this field close to black holes, the equation is as simple as this one. So it's a Proca field, is a Maxwell field with a mass term known as a Proca equation. It propagates 3 degrees of freedom as a standard massive spin one field. And the other reason is that because super radiance is stronger for electromagnetic wave than for scalar wave, we were expecting a stronger instability. The problem is that this equation is very difficult to solve on a Kerr background because it's non-separable. So you have to find a smart way to solve this problem or do a, say, brute force analysis. People have done both. So what we did was to develop a slow rotation approximation in which essentially you solve perturbatively in the spin. You get mode mixing between different parity modes, different harmonic index L. So I don't want to enter in details. There is a review written last year which explains all the details, and we can discuss them later. The result is that in the end, you get a very complicated but simple to solve, at least technically, system of ordinary differential equation that you can solve. It's an eigenvalue problem, and what you get are the modes. And a typical scenario for the instability is the following. This is the imaginary part of the mode. When you see that it changes sign in this log scale, it means that the mode becomes unstable. And it becomes unstable precisely when the spin of the black hole matches the super radiant condition. So essentially, when the mode becomes super radiant, this instability appears. And the other important thing is that the instability time scale, which is 1 over this number here, is 3 orders of magnitude shorter than in a scalar case. So essentially, the instability is stronger. And now we are very, very good in essentially exploring all the parameter space because the equation are essentially tractable. So we understand this instability very well.
So is it the case for particles of any spin that the wave equation is only separable when they're massless?
So this is actually something interesting. I didn't want to enter in details. The equation for Kerr are separable for spin 0, spin 1 half, actually, spin 1 and spin 2. Spin 1 half and the scalar field also when they have mass. The only exception seems to be this case. So spin 1 with mass. For some reason, the extra polarization messes the thing up. I mean, I don't say that it's not separable, but people have tried and with no success. So the standard Newman-Teokoski formula doesn't work. Actually, it's curious that it works, but this is actually a different problem. But in this case, it doesn't.
You guys have also done a massive gravity case, is that right?
In that case, it's much more. We didn't even try the Newman parameters, but yeah, we already went for this. Also, because that is somehow. Actually, it's not true. In the linearized case, it's not theory dependent. So yeah, in principle, one could try that too. Okay, so essentially, the idea is that you go back to the Regge plane and you play the same game that I showed you before. The difference is that since the instability is stronger, then the threshold lines extend almost to J equals zero. This is good because, as we were discussing, if these numbers here, these observational data, are slightly different, say, suppose that they lay around 0.3 as some other models and measurements would suggest, you will still get interesting constraints. So you can rule out not only, say, light vector fields as dark matter candidates, but also, in principle, if you think that you want to essentially put a constraint on the photon mass because of some weak violation of the U1 gauge invariance of Maxwell equation, for free, these results will tell you the same just because of the equivalence principle. So the equation that you are solving are really the same for supposedly massive photons. This, I should stress, is only a slow rotation approximation to second order in the spin. Helvi Witteng and collaborators have extended these results considering a highly spinning black hole, so we spin 0.99, and they solved this equation numerically. So in a fixed background, but in the extremal case, what they found is that they found the instability, essentially the mode growing. And they could actually find that because the instability is much stronger, so they don't need to evolve up to 10 to 6 to see the instability. And the nice thing is that the time scale nicely match an extrapolation of these results to the near extremal limit, meaning that essentially, to understand the qualitative picture of the instability, a second order expansion in the spin is enough. Recently, we have also extended this problem to the spin two fields, but I'm not going to discuss that. The main results is for massive spin two particle, the stability is even stronger because of what I said before. So, because super radiance is stronger for those particles.
It's a linear calculation around?
This is fixed background, so there is no back reaction. Yeah.
So all of these are, there's no back reaction.
All of these is back reaction. People like Vitor and Hirotawa Kawa in Lisbon have just started doing fully nonlinear perturbation right now, last year essentially. There is also, Franz Petrus in Princeton are doing that.
Just like this fluid waveform, right after some time scale, and you reduce by hand the background scheme.
Right, that you can do. I'm not sure that will change the time scale for the process.
Maybe a saturation at some point. I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So somehow this will already tell. Yeah. Well, this kind of simulation already you know more or less the answer, right? Because what will happen is that you start extracting angular momentum at that rate changes adiabatically, and then when the angular momentum doesn't match the super radiant instability anymore, the instability is quenched. So, but yeah.
But the growth rate.
The growth rate is going to change. Yeah.
Sorry. Is it clear that you are extracting angular momentum? Is that something that comes out of the perturbative calculus?
You can compute the flux at the horizon, and you clearly see that. It depends on this combination here. It depends on this quantity. Right. Yeah. So it depends on this quantity here. When this quantity is negative, there is flux going out of the horizon. Otherwise, it's going in.
Because this calculation we're talking, has been done. This is what Scott Hughes and collaborators have been doing with Scott's waveforms.
You mean the.
To take out back reaction in the fluid wave.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, the spirit of it, right?
Yeah.
They do avoid particles, so they know.
Sure.
Right.
So it has been done, but it has been disputed, is that what you're saying?
No, the spirit.
The spirit.
Yeah.
The spirit of the calculation has been done.
But the spirit of the calculation has been done.
Yeah. Not for its reinstability, but for
straightforward
calculation.
Right, basically.
For the spirit class.
So let me just tell you something slightly different, which is related to primordial black holes that I will discuss later. But the interesting thing to me is that sometimes you don't need actually a exotic like particles to trigger the instability, because the mass term can be an effective mass triggered by essentially given by nonlinear interactions. For example, this is the case for normal photons, so massless photons propagating in a plasma. So it's well known that there is a cutoff frequency given by the plasma frequency, which is just scales as the square root of the plasma density. And so essentially, photons within a plasma, so the dispersion relation is such that low-frequency photon with frequency smaller than the plasma frequency do not propagate. So effectively, for these photons, the plasma behaves like a confining cavity. And this is interesting for primordial black holes in the early universe. The reason being that this mass term, of course, is not fixed, but actually it changes during the evolution of the universe, and it changes because as the universe expands, the volume becomes bigger, and the density of the plasma density grows as the redshift to the tree, essentially. Why this is interesting? Because suppose that now you have this primordial black hole, which are of course very small objects. With a mass, say, 10 to minus 4, this is just to make the point, and some spin around 0.6. Then, essentially, the effective mass changes with the redshift, so the instability also changes with the redshift. What happens is that at redshift 10 to 6, this is the instability region, meaning that everything inside this region here will be unstable. But then, essentially, and this black hole will actually be stable at redshift 10 to 6, but then as the time passes by, the instability moves from the left to the right, until essentially this black hole enters the instability region. And so what happens is that, for example, in this case, at redshift 10 to 5, this black hole starts losing energy and angular momentum. We can actually compute how much energy is released into the plasma. So in this diagram, what we'll do will be losing angular momentum, so going down until the superheating condition is not satisfied. And by computing the energy and the angular momentum, eventually is releasing this energy in the cosmic microwave background. So it's changing the early evolution of the universe. And well, we have very strong constraints on the cosmic microwave background, which is almost a perfect black body. In particular, you can compute that this kind of mechanism will contribute to introduce a chemical potential to the cosmic microwave background. And by using this argument, and the fact that we have very strong constraints on the cosmic microwave background, what we could do is reverse and try to put constraints on the abundance of primordial black holes in the early universe because of this effect. This is what we have done with Avi Loeb last year, trying to put essentially constraints on the dark matter fraction in primordial black holes in the case in which primordial black holes are spinning. The interesting thing is that, for example, using the data from the COBE satellite, you put constraints in a some mass range for the primordial black holes. And the interesting thing is that these constraints are competitive with what you essentially real experiments have been done to try to constrain primordial black holes, like the Macho experiment here. So in some cases they can be more competitive, more stringent, and they only actually essentially they are confined in some mass range because depending on the redshift you don't have essentially energy injection for this process. Yes, please. So, if you are interested, essentially this cutoff here is because as ratio is smaller than 10 to 6, you don't have any energy injection. So essentially the universe is transparent to this radiation. And this one instead is the ionization. So essentially at the ratio 10 to 3, you don't get anymore the same effect. So this is why. So essentially, a black hole with this mass here will be unstable only a redshift larger than 10 to 6. And at that redshift, the universe will be transparent to this radiation. So essentially, you are adding radiation, but it thermalizes, and it doesn't change the black body spectrum. This is what.
I mean, the universe isn't transparent at less than that redshift either. So I'm not sure where you get the 10 to 6 from.
The 10 to 6,
universe isn't not transparent after what redshift?
Well, I mean, last scattering is redshift of 1,000, so.
But it's for the different frequencies.
It's frequency independent, so.
No, but it depends on the process that essentially gives you dissipation. So all of this only works for ratios larger than 10 to 6, so for the earlier times. But there is essentially a cutoff given by the fact that process is not efficient anymore.
I think it's Compton
scattering. So it's computing the efficiency of Compton scattering during the evolution.
You're claiming that at less than 10 to the 6, then the universe is transparent to this.
Less, you mean smaller than 2 to 6, right?
Yeah.
No, actually, it will be so. The radiation will otherwise, exactly. Yeah.
But there's a bigger than 10 to the 6 is transparent.
Right. So you essentially, yeah, it doesn't change the spectrum, right? The power spectrum.
Right. No, I think now there are two different statements.
It's not that it's transparent, just that it doesn't.
So there is a significance that if you inject some energy, so the question is, can you change the number of photons or not change the number of photons? And,
right.
And something, I think, somewhere around 10 to the 6, although I don't quite remember exactly that.
It's a different measure for the different types of distortion, isn't it? And this is a new distortion.
It's a time scale for the new
spectral distortion.
Right.
And then it's like 10 to the 6.
So that's one statement. But the other statement is that the idea is that you want to emit these photons and let them take angular momentum away. But if these photons cannot move, how could they take the angular momentum away? Because the universe is very opaque at high redshifts. Then, you make these photons, but they cannot go anywhere because they're just scattering off. So that's the other concern.
But I think that would be the ultimate calculation.
Right. So the only thing that you really do here would be computing in a ratio dependent way how the mu the form the formation depend on the redshift.
Well, I mean, the thing I'm concerned is that those chaos are
chaos in vacuum space time, right? So I mean, you have the mass, mm-hmm. but there is no interaction, there is no scattering. And I think if you're doing it in a plasma, it's not just the mass that you get; you also get the scattering. So your photons couldn't just go into infinity to take your angular momentum. They might scatter and come back in. So.
That I see. Well, I'm not sure that is taking. So the picture actually will be that. So after you release this energy in the plasma, eventually this essentially the plasma density is going down. So essentially the barrier goes down and eventually it can be released.
But why is it going down? I mean, you're dumping energy into the plasma. So indeed. Don't you affect also the effective mass there?
Well, but that is. What do you mean?
You're saying that your effective mass is due to non-linear terms.
So
if these are growing, then my barrier is also changing.
But it's mostly due to the fact that it's changing because of the redshift. So it's a sort of adiabatic approximation.
So changing due to the process itself, right? So I'm taking energy from the black hole. The non-linear terms are growing because of a radiance, so then your effective barriers also changing
in
time.
Oh, yeah, but those are assumed to be much smaller than the redshift effects.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is a master. It's not really due to the energy released in the process, right? I mean, it's not really due to the energy in the say, photon cloud that is trapped. So it's really due, essentially, it's case with, it's much larger because it's given by the plasma density. So it's. Such as a background quantity, which is, right. I mean, for the perturbative approach to be consistent, should be much larger than this perturbation.
Is it consistent?
Sorry? This should be consistent, right? Because essentially, so this is a perturbative analysis. So the energy is growing linearly, and that is much smaller than the background quantity. So I think so what I'm saying is that the correction to this barrier given by the fact that the photons are growing there is higher order with respect to the background quantity. So they are small.
So are you assuming near the primordial black hole, the plasma density is constant?
So in the simplest case, we don't. So what we consider is that there is a radial profile. So we don't consider any angular dependence. What we consider is a radial profile given by something like that, essentially. Very, very.
I mean, I'm not talking about redshift. I'm just talking about one redshift, just near primordial black hole. I would guess the density of the plasma would change.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what we essentially we have a model in which at the disk of the black hole there is a maximum. Of the density, so the density is a maximum there, and then it goes down close to from the disk to the horizon, and there is much smaller, so there is a depletion, and then it goes to a constant at larger distances, essentially.
So you have a changing of density, then you have a non-trivial dispersion, then.
Right. Yeah. Then so this quantity here is non-homogeneous, so it depends on the radius, so it's not really a mass, it's an effective mass.
In your computation, you have already taken into account this radius dependence of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
So another question is, I don't know, why these primordial black holes have to have angular momentum? Why can they just be...
Right, that's a good question. There is no reason why they should or they should not, essentially. It depends on the formation mechanism. I can tell you, so essentially this constraint here, there is a spin factor here. It means that, of course, since this is super radiance, if the spin is zero, there is no constraint. So for non-spinning black hole, there is no such instability. Of course, after they are formed, they start accrete both mass and angular momentum. So you would expect that they have, to some extent, some spin. It depends, of course, on the mass and the formation process, and also the time when they are formed.
So just come back to Neonish's point. You know, it might be a little bit easier to describe if you just say that you're exciting Langmuir waves in the plasma. That's what you're really doing. And they're not photons, they're Langmuir waves, they're collective plasma waves. That's why they have that dispersion relation. And then talking about dissipation via scattering, know, that might be Landau damping, so there's a well-defined way to calculate that dissipation rate. Otherwise, you go to nonlinear things, wave particle interactions. But those are all easily calculable, and I'm not sure. I would imagine that, that you could cook up a situation where the instability grows faster than any of those damping schemes.
Aren't these things all roughly folded into Avilov's magical? Or wait, was this with Avilov?
Yes,
sir.
Yeah.
What magical machine?
Magical what?
The magical getting her Vancouver right.
No. So if the damping time scale was short in comparison to the growth time scale from plasma processes, which is effectively what scattering would be, but it's a lot more complicated when you have a collective interaction, then you'd never grow anything. And this process wouldn't matter.
What
it would inject heat.
Sorry, given the time, the meetings of time are
all right, yeah, so let me, well, actually. Let me do the
second part very quickly, which actually was what I wanted to discuss today, but anyway. So this is based on this paper, which was submitted a couple of months ago. So in this picture, I was trying to represent, say, the balloon and ballet process. What I want to let you notice is that in this process here, perhaps you can see that, but there are sort of surface wave in the balloon, and this is relevant for what I'm going to say you next. So the second part is about neutron stars as dark matter probes. I will skip this, which is some work by Berton and Fairbairn, who started this kind of idea. So let me just tell you what we have done, actually. So the idea is to try to constrain primordial black holes as dark matter candidates. I didn't actually yet introduce primordial black holes. They are small black holes that are formed in the early universe due to some density fluctuations. Depending on the formation mechanism, they may have different masses. So this is essentially they have a quite huge mass spectrum. By comparing essentially the density of in the early universe with the horizon density, you can compute the mass depending on the time of the formation. This gives you a rough estimate. So essentially, they have a mass that can vary from 10 to 5 grams to even more than solar masses. And well, the thing why I was interested in that is that somehow they might be one of the most natural and economic dark matter candidates. The reason being that they are non-relativistic, so they are cold dark matter. They are weakly interacting, and especially they don't require any extension of the standard model. So essentially, as somebody has put it, there will be a gravitational solution to a gravitational problem without requiring any new physics. However, people were initially very excited by them. Problem is that after the discovery of Hawking evaporation, you realize that any black hole with mass smaller than 10 to 15 grams, so in this region here, will evaporate before the present time. So essentially, they will already be evaporated by now. So they cannot form dark matter. This is why we have very strong constraints on the dark matter fraction in this region here. And also from experiments like COBE, WMAP, et cetera, Macho's experiment, essentially microlensing or cosmic surveys, there are other very strong constraints in this mass range here. So above 10 to 25 grams. This is because the very simple reason is that if these primordial black holes are too massive, they have strong gravitational effect that we can actually constrain. If they are too light, they will evaporate very quickly, so they don't exist anymore. But there was this mass range between 10 to 17 and 10 to 24 grams, which was unconstrained by experiment. In principle, in this region, in this regime here, primordial black holes could form the entirety of dark matter. This box is just to say the unconstrained rate.
10 to 25, 10 to 35, but with a ratio below 10 to minus 2, say.
So this region is allowed, so yeah. But of course, the interesting thing would be to explain all the dark matter in primordial black hole. So essentially, you want this number to be 1. Otherwise, they would be just, say, few percent of the dark matter. So the interesting thing is that precisely in that region I show you, the interaction between neutron star and primordial black holes gives you interesting phenomenology. This was recognized by Fabio Capella, Tiniakov, and collaborators last year. So they were considering the encounter of a neutron star and a primordial black hole. And the idea is the following. If during this encounter, the primordial black hole releases, loss enough energy to be gravitationally captured, you can compute the time it takes to be essentially captured by a neutron star, eventually ending up inside the neutron star core. And if this happens, in a very short time, it will destroy the neutron star by accretion. And the reason is that inside a neutron star core, the density is so high that the bonding accretion is very efficient. So what they were studying is essentially this process. There is a primordial black hole going through the neutron star, and they computed the accretion and the dynamical friction that occurs during the process, so essentially the interaction of the primordial black hole with its own wake. And the energy release is the following here. So it's essentially depending on the mass ratio. This is the standard Chandrasekhar computation, and also Stryker did something related. What we were considering is the following, and so it's the following process. It's something very, very different. So what we considered was, suppose that the primordial black hole now is on a parabolic orbit defined by some periastron r min. Then we wanted to compute the energy that is deposited inside the modes of this neutron star. Right, actually you should be, right. Yeah, well, I was just copy and pasting this picture here. What happened is that this process was already computed for a neutron star-neutron star interaction by Preston Tokoski in the 70s. Of course, at that time, they were just modeling it as a point particle, the smallest neutron star. But for the case I'm discussing, this is very good because primordial black hole, so the mass ratio that I'm considering here is smaller than 10 to minus 8. So it's a very small mass ratio. And what they found is this interesting result. So the energy loss in the transfer from the black hole into neutron star mode depends on this mass ratio here, the size ratio between the primordial black hole and the radius of the neutron star. And then there is this sum, the composition in normal modes of the neutron star. This function TL is of order 1. And in their case, the periastron is, of course, bigger than the Roche radius, meaning that R over R min is smaller than 1. And this series converges very quickly. This is the point. So the total energy is just given by this factor here times a coefficient. But then the interesting thing is that suppose now that the primordial black hole, since it's not tidally distracted, can go very close to the neutron star surface and even moving through the neutron star, essentially. So what will happen when this ratio is of order 1, so when R min is exactly equal to R, is that this sum does not converge anymore. Of course, this is just an expectation, but it tells you that the closer the particle can go to the neutron star radius, the bigger is the contribution of higher L modes, essentially. So what we did, and I'll be very brief, well, this is just to tell you that this energy goes into surface mode of the neutron star, so essentially on surface oscillations that are essentially balanced between the pressure and the gravity force. So what we did was to compute precisely this process when the primordial black hole is infalling radially into the neutron star. And to do that, we use a formula borrowed from seismology. And the reason is that in seismology, people study earthquakes in the same way. So they consider a point source close to the Earth's surface, and they compute how the Earth surface, essentially the Earth fluid displacement, reacts to this source. So, well, the formula is very standard. It's just a green function approach. You compute the covolution between the source term and the fluid displacement. What you find, so what we found is this curious result, that if you decompose the energy in this harmonic index, the energy of the harmonic index L goes like this ratio again, but then in the large L limit goes like 1 over L to the power of n, where n is the polytropic index of the neutron star. So it's given by this number here. And you recognize that when n is smaller than 1, this sum, so this term here, when you compute the sum in the total range, does not converge anymore. It's something curious that we thought it was related to the polytropic approximation, but then we consider tabulated equation of state. And even for tabulated equation of states, when they describe realistic neutron stars, the effect is again there, essentially shown in this picture here. You see that the, well, essentially the slope of this curve, which is EL as a function of L, is smaller than one. So essentially this means that realistic equation of states behaves very similarly to a polytropic index in this context when n is smaller than one. And the reason is that when you compute the adiabatic index as a function of the density, there are regions close to the neutron star core in which this adiabatic index is smaller than one. So essentially, for any realistic equation of states between the crust and the core transition, there are regions in which the equation is very stiff. This is the point. Okay. Well, I'm probably running out of time, so let me just skip this thing. So essentially, what we did is to understand this process was to compute an analytical model, so a toy model using an incompressible fluid. This is very simple, but on the other end, can be solved analytically, so it somehow gives you an insight of the process, and essentially tells you that this energy increase is due to the fact that when the source goes through essentially the transition between the core and the crust, there is an energy increase because the normal modes are peaked there, essentially, because they are supported by the boundary conditions. So in this case, what you compute is the total, so is the energy for a given L for the incompressible fluid, and it goes like a constant. Essentially, it's the particular case of this formula here when n is equal to 0. And this is curious because for a black hole, people already in the 70s have computed the same process, and they found the same result. So when a particle is essentially falls down into a black hole, the energy absorbed at the horizon, so not the one that is emitted in gravitational wave, but the one that is absorbed at the horizon, is constant in the larger limit. So essentially, if you sum this energy, it does not converge. This was something that was known for the black holes. Curiously, it happens the same for neutron stars, well, at least for an incompressible fluid, which is, of course, an idealized situation. Well, I should tell you that there is something that we are still debating with Fabio Capella and collaborators. If you are interested, we can discuss this later. What I want to tell you is that for essentially when you use realistic equation of states for which the divergence is much more is much milder than this one because it decays with some power of L, you can actually regularize the energy by introducing a cutoff in the angular momentum, and essentially what you do is introducing finite size effect. You cannot sum above a particular angular momentum number because essentially you will resolve the black hole size.
Even if you have zero size, you cannot, you have a finite energy in the system, you cannot impart infinite energy to neutron stuff. So even at zero size, there must be some other physical process that limits this divergence.
I agree with you. I don't know. I don't have any answer. The only thing that I know is that for these two cases, well, actually for all these cases in which n is smaller than one, for the black hole too, this is what it happens. Yeah.
So I mean, one thing is that why has this been a good expansion in terms of L? I can imagine that there's a lot of. Why should you impart some energy? Can you gain energy from some else and give energy to some other else? So is the sign always one?
No, I don't think so. Well, because so what you are doing here is really so the background is fixed. So this is a point particle. It goes through, and it follows geodesics. So it's at next order, of course, these modes can modify the geodetic motion, but at this order it doesn't. So you are really just computing the energy that it goes. That is released in the process. Okay, very short because I'm completely out of time. When you regularize the energy this way, of course this is already interesting by itself. We can discuss it later. But what happens is that you can compute how much time does this black hole takes to end up inside a neutron star. So essentially, this machinery was already available. What you find is that any non-evaporating primordial black hole would be captured in a time that is shorter than the neutron star lifetime. And then the last point is that you have to compute the capture rate. So essentially, the probability for a primordial black hole given some sort of velocity distribution for dark matter and dark matter density, so the probability that is really captured by a neutron star in the first place. By considering all these effects, what you find in the end is that since we do observe neutron stars, the probability for this capture must be very small, otherwise the neutron star would be destroyed, and this translates in an interesting bound for the dark matter fraction in primordial black holes, which lie exactly in the region that was not probed by experiments.
Black hole. I mean, that's why that's
after he essentially is confined inside a neutron star, that is extremely short because it's proportional to the density of the neutrons. I think it's smaller than the second because the density is huge. Because essentially it grows. So yeah, because the Bondi timescale is linear in the density. So it is in this case the density is 10 to 14 grams per centimeter cube. So it's it's very good.
Oh, does have mass square.
Sorry?
The area, the surface area.
But what is important is that in the surrounding of the black hole, I mean, essentially sees the density, right? So what is difficult is actually the first process, so the capture rate, because the area of the neutron star is already small because it's very compact, and yeah. So that is actually the limit of the process. This is just to tell you that if you include these theoretical bounds together with new constraint by Kepler and new experimental bounds, essentially these results suggest that not the totality of dark matter can be explained by primordial black holes because there are very strong constraints essentially for any mass. I'm doing the relativistic analysis right now, but since I'm running out of time, if you are interested, we can discuss it later. There are strange results that I don't understand yet, but if you are interested, we can discuss it. I think I'll conclude here. I hope I convinced you that compact objects are interesting dark matter probes, so laboratories to study extension of the standard model and of general relativity. And, well, my main message is that interesting competitive bounds can be put right now, and future electromagnetic gravitational facilities will only open new territories. But it's an exciting period for this kind of research. Thank you.
There was at least one follow-up paper about disputing the result. Is that
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
What,
yeah.
What,
so
what,
this
what
was
is...
related to this. Well, I wanted to talk about that. Let me briefly tell you their point. So their point was there are essentially two points. One is that this process should have the same. So this tidal heating that I was discussing should actually be equivalent to dynamical friction. Then this I don't really agree with. For the following reason. One is very simple. This tidal heating also occurs when the primordial black hole is moving outside a neutron star and when there is no dynamical friction.
Why isn't there is dynamical friction even if it's outside.
Sorry?
There is dynamical friction even when the primordial black hole is outside.
But it's not the one that is usually computed. Like if you take Chandrasekhar formula.
Right, because that's in a homogeneous medium, obviously. So
right.
The star is not a homogeneous medium. But it doesn't matter. It's the gravitational effect. It could be inside or outside.
But there are no estimates for the case in which outside. Well, actually, this is the estimate for the case in which outside.
Well,
right.
So
no, so their point is that you should get exactly this energy here, which is computed for an homogeneous medium, zero pressure, and the particle inside, of course, because it should be the same effect. My point here is that this is a cohesive effect. So it's important that the pressure is crucial because if in the pressureless case if the equation of state is not compact enough, you don't get this effect. So it's something really that depends on essentially how the pressure and density behave.
This is saying that by
by moving the primordial black hole outside the neutron star, it extracts energy. It excites the neutron star more efficiently than it would have if it had plowed through the neutron star?
No, actually, it means that the energy that goes into the modes of the neutron star, which is not computed by dynamical friction because it's an infinite medium, the energy that goes in the surface mode can be much larger. If the frequency.
Right.
No, in reality, what you should get are both effects. So in some case, one is dominant, in the other case, is the other. Yeah. My impression, I mean, I agree with you. My impression is that if you sum.
I thought the bigger effect was just the question of which. After what L do you go?
Yeah.
That was a really essential issue because that determined how much energy you lose. Mm.
Right.
The difference there is not like a small thing. It's like cutting at 500 versus cutting at 10 to the 5 or so.
That was the second point that was not discussed. So these are two different issues. One was that they are referring with this dynamical friction to estimate the energy. And the other one is what I'm saying here. So their point, and actually this was a good point because it helped us to extend the model, is that in realistic neutron star, so this is really not a matter of principle. It's really, if you take a realistic neutron star, there is the core crust transition. And their point is that there should be a cutoff in L, which is much smaller than the one that I showed before, is about 500, because the modes should actually peak inside the crust. Because essentially, if you don't impose any boundary condition, the modes peak at a distance which is more or less R minus 1 over L, essentially. So the larger the L, the closer the mode is peaked close to the surface. The thing that I didn't discuss, but is the result of this picture here, this plot here, is that once you have a core crust transition, then you have to impose boundary conditions there. And once you impose boundary conditions, some of your modes peak at the core crust transition. So essentially, the same effect that I was discussing, so when the particle crosses the radius, it will happen when the particle crosses the core crust transition, because the modes in this case peak there. So even at very high L, so here I'm summing up to 10 to 4, and what you see is that the result is essentially it doesn't change.
But it should be a factor of dependence. So the density ratio between the surface and outside is much higher than
the
crust and interior.
That's true, it does. So essentially, yeah, it depends on the essentially step that you have in the density. Yeah. In this case, I was using a factor 10 to 3, I think, for the, well, but these are really just a toy model. But yeah, it does depend on that.
I didn't quite understand what core you're citing with. Are you citing with low core or are you citing with saying that the cutoff should be 500?
500 is Capella and collaborators, the comment.
Sorry?
It's Capella and collaborators. The 500, what they say is the comment of the paper.
I guess you agree with it.
I don't agree actually with that. So
what is the maximum L in your opinion?
In my case would be, what was that? I have to say I didn't find any smaller cutoff than this theoretically. So I'm in principle using the mass ratio, the size ratio. In practice, to prove that essentially is not that cutoff dependent, what I did here was to consider an artificial cutoff given by 10 to 6. This essentially gives you an angular resolution of the order of the centimeters, while these black holes are micrometers. So it's four orders of magnitude bigger than the smallest case in the problem. And still you get much stronger constraint because the energy is still much, much bigger. So my point is that I don't see any reason to have that 500, L equal 500, because the real modes peak at the core crust transition because of this density gradient and not at the radius as they were claiming. Please.
I'm just wondering, you said the capture rate is high enough that every neutron star would have captured a black hole that would destroy it, right? But how high enough is it? Is it like way more than enough or just barely enough?
This is the capture rate, actually. Essentially what you do is computing the probability that a neutron star capture a primordial black hole within its lifetime. So for the lifetime, we take 10 to 9 years. So if this probability is much small, I mean, must be very small, and then you get this threshold line. So essentially, what you require is that within the neutron star's lifetime, it doesn't, the probability to capture one primordial black hole is very small.
That's right, so I'm asking the other way. So what's the calculation telling you? Is the probability, you know, one, extremely close to one, given the density of dark matter? And
well, that's the problem is, so in this picture, in this formula here, is degenerate with the density of the dark matter.
But if you assume that all the dark matter is
primordial black holes in this range.
Yeah, but so it depends on the density, of dark matter near the neutron star. And that we don't know. So there are two parameters, and this is why there are two plots here. One is the dark matter density.
No, the value.
What?
Yeah, that certainly won't help. You really need to know the density of dark matter in that neutron star environment.
Right.
It's much larger than what, for example, what we have.
So you have to invoke that? Okay, that's part of my question. How much enough? So suppose I assumed it was just the same density, it's this average density of dark matter in the universe.
So these constraints here are linear in the density, in the dark matter density. So for example, you take this curve here, this is a more or less 10 to minus 2. If you decrease the dark matter density by a factor 100, this goes up above 1, and you don't get any constraint.
So it's
really dependent on how much dark matter density you have close to the neutron star. And that depends on the system, of course.
Dark matter density is in the galaxy.
So for the Milky Way, it's difficult to understand close to the galactic core. But there are others. So here, for example, in this case here, we are using the estimates for the large Magellanic Cloud, and in close to the center is about 1 GeV per centimeter cube. And on the top of that, it also depends on the relative velocity dispersion between the dark matter and the neutron star, and this is another unknown. So there are these two unknowns.
I'm just wondering whether you pondered the implication of what you're saying. You're saying that if you take a star with relative entropy index, Newtonian gravity, I have a point particle that passes at the distance of 1,000 times the size of a star, it imparts infinite energy.
No, it doesn't, because so what I'm doing here is a radial info. So the crucial point is that must be very close to the radius. If it doesn't, so it's this formula here. This is actually. It should more or less, it should cross a region in which there is a big gradient in density.
That's the thing.
The
divergence in L is associated with the info being exactly radial?
No, that is not. It's related to the fact that it touches or goes arbitrarily close to the neutron star surface.
How close is arbitrarily close? Obviously, it's not going
to
be.
Well, in practice, what we did was to consider the particle goes through the neutron star. Of course, this makes you the. If it goes outside, say 2R, the effect is very small.
Is the cutoff L then set by the fact that once you get closer than once you're approximately radial infile, if it turns out to actually go tangent to the neutron star, that once you get within 2 radii, it's no longer approximately radial.
The cutoff is the angular size of the particle seen in the friendly star.
Yeah, it's not the angular.
Just imagine it's finite particle, and you start adding. Waveforms or whatever.
But then that can't be the only cutoff because, like Nyanich says, if it was not at all radial, if it was just off in the Andromeda galaxy and the neutron star was over here, then the answer would be.
Well, there's also another constraint.
But that is still a cutoff. Now it depends on which one is more stringent.
There's also another thing.
But that is a geodesic cutoff, right? I mean,
it's a point part. It has to break down somewhere.
Some flyby time, and that flyby time dictates the spread in frequencies you can excite modes in, and everything with shorter wavelengths than that is going to be strongly coupled. And I think that might be part of the cure of this divergence in energy, in that you no longer have a number of independent modes; you can just sum up the energies of. It's not that they haven't been excited; it's not power hasn't been excited in them. It's that they're all strongly correlated.
No, that's the opposite, because these are high frequencies. Your problem is in the low frequencies. L is high frequency.
So Nyanich's question just makes me think, is the cutoff L, there another cutoff in L which is the
frequency?
The
sorry?
It's just the bandwidth that you can excite is given by how long the particle, the point particle, passed by the star. Okay, so then that's the spectrum. That's the bandwidth of the spectrum you're allowed to excite. Everything outside of that is entirely dictated by what's inside. So then you don't get extra energy associated with those modes.
That's related to the attitude.
That's the physical intuition. And
I think it sounds like the cutoff L should be the size of the neutron star divided by the impact parameter.
Yeah. Oh. Well, the size of the neutron star divided by the time crossing time or something like this.
Depending on
that,
if you touch
the
frequency.
Divided by the velocity of the time.
No, but that gives you a lower frequency, not an upper frequency.
It gives you the maximum number of independent modes.
But the bandwidth is defined in the archives by the lower and upper, right? That problem arises in the lower. A different problem, unrelated, that Preston already mentioned, is you can't have, it's somewhat related, okay? The particle has to be sufficiently far away from the star, so outside of the star, so you don't have any coherence, any negative interference between this excitation. That's a different thing. But I think he also took that into account, if I remember.
Right, yeah.
So that's
like,
isn't that similar? Isn't that saying the same thing? That, you know, you'll have negative or destructive interference, but negative coherence, that's what you're saying, when your modes aren't independent. Right? When I say I'm going to sum up the energy in the tidally excited
modes, I said
that they're independent.
Okay, one question is adding energy.
Yeah.
And that's adding energy between multiple encounters with the star. That's one thing. This is what, right? That's the destructive interference. You can add it.
No, we're talking about a single encounter.
A single encounter, this destructive interference doesn't arise. Okay? And I think that the star size sets a lower frequency.
I think it sets. I think there is enough. It's like, why does the moon dominantly excite the quadrupole of the Earth? And it does not dominate. It does not excite the L equal to million mode of the Earth. It's because of the. Because the upper limit on it, because the excitation of L drops off, given by the impact parameter, which is given the distance of the moon divided by the distance of the Earth. And so I think, you know, in other words,
yeah, see what I mean. I don't know. I should look into that.
I mean, that statement is surely independent of the equation state of the Earth.
It is, yeah. But I would say that that gives you lower bound on the frequency, actually an upper bound on the frequency. So yeah, essentially, it tells you that, well, in the related to that, it tells you that you can't excite anything above the light crossing time of the neutron star, right? So, but that is the low frequency cutoff. So there is also a time cutoff that is related to the frequency. But the interesting thing here is that the frequency in the larger limit from this formula here goes like square root of L. So it's smaller than the cutoff that goes like L in the mass ratio.
I think what you need is an actual calculation.
Can you not use the standard, Preston Kolsky did this point source passing by, exciting modes, and tidal capture and all of that. Can't you use that? I mean, I remember writing a bunch of papers on this for white dwarfs.
Yeah, but that's how Zoom is very good.
Yeah, so I'm not using that.
But let's never put the particle crossing the star, that's the thing, because of that factor.
Right, yeah.
I mean, you read the seismology papers and they have this. They never comment, but they have an energy growing without. They know, of course, there must be some cutoff, but that no one never mentions a cutoff.
For some reason, every time we did this, I never worried much about what was happening at IL. And I like Latham would see dominantly below L's.
Yeah.
Are interesting, but I suppose if there was a very small residual high L's, I wouldn't notice.
I was worried because in black hole space, sometimes I noticed some years ago already, that this happens. Whatever space I'm in, the energy going into the black hole increases with linearly with hours. So it depends on the space and dimension. So that is a problem. You need a cutoff that you don't need when you're computing other quantities. So it's
yeah, and also there's also another reason why usually you don't care about that. It's because for say sun-like stars, the equation of say is not stiff enough to give you this effect. So you don't really see that. So when n
Well,
even assuming say an idealized situation, when this n, you take a polytrop. When that n is larger than one, which is already quite a strong requirement, because white dwarf, for example, are n equal 3. So it's much larger than what you need to see this divergence. In that case, it's perfectly fine. So at l equal 4 is already convergent, essentially. So you don't really need to go to higher l.
Yeah.